Hi, this is Daniel Garber, the movies for CulturalMoney.com and CIUT 89.5 FM. Japan joined the European race for colonies late in the game, but they took it with a vengeance, expanding ever southward, Taiwan, Korea, Manchuria, and by the 1930s, they began to seize territory in eastern China, Southeast Asia, and islands of the Pacific and South China Seas. And at the vanguard of all this was the Japanese Imperial Army. To keep the soldiers free from venereal disease, they initiated a program of frontline comfort women. Over 200,000 girls and young women from Japanese colonies were forced into sexual slavery to serve the troops. Because of the shame involved, the survivors remained silent for 50 years. But what happened to them? What are their stories, and what apologies do they seek? The Apology is a new NFB feature documentary that follows three elderly comfort women from Korea, China, and the Philippines who survived that terrible ordeal. The Apology is opening in Toronto today, and I'm very pleased to have the film's director, Tiffany Hsiung, here in studio to tell us more about the film. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
Thanks for coming. So The Apology is your first feature documentary. Why did you choose this topic? How did you hear about it?
I heard about it back in 2009 when I was invited to document a study tour that was hosted by Alpha Education based in Toronto, and their mandate was to take educators from North America to Asia and to learn about the history in World War II and through the stories of the survivors all across Asia. So I was there along with them, documenting the teachers, but at the same time learning a lot of this for the first time. And it was when I first heard the testimonies of one of the grandmothers in Shanghai that just struck me. It was shocking to hear, to know that this happened. And the fact that I was just learning about this now versus, you know, being taught this in school or even reading about it or even have it passed down from my own parents was really frustrating. And so that kind of the frustration really propelled that, like, okay, someone needs to do something about this. I need to learn more about this. And so that led to me staying there for a longer time after the study tour and just doing more and more research and meeting more of the grandmothers in different regions as well.
So there were three grandmothers in the movie, Grandma Gil from South Korea, Grandma Cao from China, and Grandma Della from the Philippines.
Yes.
So let's start with Grandma Gil. She's different from the other two in that she put herself into the public eye before the press. Why did she do that? And tell me about her motives.
You know, in her story, it's actually quite interesting because she would consider herself also a late story because she had come out actually a lot later than the other grandmothers. And so often she takes on that, well, I have to do all the traveling now. I have to do all this work because the other survivors, they've been doing this for a very long time. It's now my turn. And so she kind of carries that torch around with her. And her story of coming out, again, it's not that she immediately thought that this was what she was going to do. It was in the late 90s when she first heard about this on the news. And yet first she was actually quite ashamed by these other women, you know, protesting and demonstrating. And it wasn't until like her daughter-in-law saw her mother-in-law's facial reaction, which like, there's something wrong here. Do you want to tell me something? And then slowly her own story came out. And eventually they decided to actually go to the Korean Council and to actually share her own story with the Korean Council. And since then she became part of the public eye and really the face of this movement right now.
So where did she take her story to?
So she took the Korean Council is a council draft, like their specific mandate is to help survivors that were drafted into military sexual slavery during World War II. And they also have created a museum in Seoul as well. And they're the ones that lead the Wednesday demonstration for over 25 years now. And so they actually, after the first comfort woman that came out in 1992, they actually started a hotline available for women to call in. And back then, Grandma Gil didn't call in. And it wasn't until several years afterwards where she actually saw them on TV, did she understand that this was a big movement that was growing and that was picking up?
So let's go back in time. It's a very grisly, horrible topic, but I wonder if you can describe what it was like for her or for the typical girl who was pulled into this horrible situation?
Well, I mean, all the stories are so different from each of the grandmothers. And, you know, Grandma Gill's story particularly was one very heartbreaking, because after she was taken away by a man who had promised her a job at a factory. And so she thought she was going to go and earn some money at the age of 13. And in fact, she was put on a train and she was never able to come back home ever again. Grandma Gill is taken from North Korea, and so after the war, the borders were already built up, and even though she had gone back to Korea, she was on the south side, and so she actually never was able to return home, so her family actually never knew where she ended off, and she was never able to actually communicate with her parents afterwards. And so she was drafted, she was taken for over 4 years to China, and then finally was able to, once the war was over, was able to come back to Korea.
And she and other cover women were put into places called comfort stations.
Yes.
Can you describe what that was?
So comfort stations were either like abandoned schools or hospitals or people's homes, and the Japanese army would actually take over these places and create these institutionalized sexual slavery systems where they actually even brought in doctors and nurses, mainly not for the women, but for the soldiers, to make sure they don't contract any diseases and to make sure all the women were clean enough for them to be raped by these soldiers. And so the system was, you know, very thought through, because there was a way to lining up and queuing in and name tags, and you know, every woman had their own little room. But I would say over the few years that I was documenting this, I visited different types of comfort stations that, you know, that there was marking still left over from the war of how they situated these women. So if it wasn't in a school where there was little tiny rooms built up, then it was like a cave, and it was like these women were separated through like artillery weapons were used as like the divide between each woman. So the situations was different in every regions, you know, where they set up these comfort stations.
And I understand they were in virtually every occupied territory that the Japanese were in. I read references to people in tiny Pacific islands that had mm-hmm. tiny comfort stations set mm-hmm. up always for the soldiers.
Yeah, wherever they went, there was a comfort station. And so, I mean, through back to like the apology really focuses on the human story and the aftermath of what, you know, how the women have lived with this all their life, but really following their contemporary journey to seeking justice, not just with the Japanese government, but even within their own homes, even with themselves, to be able to reveal this to their families.
So relatively few of the comfort women survived the war, but those that did, what happened to them? Give some examples of people.
Well,
so they did not talk about it. Why not?
For a lot of the grandmothers, the ones that survived, the ones that were able to go back home, often they didn't tell. Like if they did tell their parents, it would only just stay with their parents and not outside, even to, you know, their relatives or people in their community, because they just wanted their daughters to be able to have a life afterwards and to still be able to be married off and still be able to have a family. And back then, the stigma was very strong that, you know, if they were raped or if they were a sexual slave for the Japanese Imperial Army, no family would want to be part of that and be, you know, part of that history. And so they often kept it a secret. And so the women that were, you know, the women that had faced all these atrocities decided that they were going to keep this a secret. And if you could imagine decades upon decades of holding that secret, was really difficult for these women. And it's only until, you know, well after their own families were able to have their own kids, slowly did the grandmothers start coming out with their stories.
And you refer to them as grandmas because that's how old they are now. But after the war, many of them were as young as 11.
Yes.
When they were kidnapped.
Yes.
So now they're grandmas.
Now they're grandmothers.
They're old ladies.
Yeah, exactly. But that's in Chinese and in Korean.
For sure.
We refer to them as grandmothers. Anyone in that age region, we call them grandmothers.
Now, the grandmother Adela, Grandma Adela in the Philippines, she, through the course of the movie, she has to decide whether she's going to reveal her secret to a family member. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, so when I first met Grandma Adela, it was what really struck me was that her only wish was to be able to one day tell her family. And seeing that all the other grandmother's wishes were very much the same of wishing justice from the Japanese government, Grandma's only wish, Grandma Adele's only wish was to one day be able to tell her family. And she was convinced at that point, it was like, it was never going to happen because they would disown me and reject me. And it's just better for me just to keep this a secret. And so her journey of even understanding, even though she was part of this group of survivors, that she still embodied that shame, you know, and that she was still unable to talk about this to her own family members. And so throughout the years, just watching her go through that and kind of understanding her own process of the shame that she's been carrying was incredibly difficult, because, you know, the things that she's been facing and still going through are similar things that young women today still go through. The contemplation of, should I talk about this? Should I come out? But there's all the stigma around it. And these are things that are happening right here in Canada, all around the world, where young people have to think about whether or not they want to do that because of what society and this community has done to, like, almost kind of shame people for, you know, speaking out, or why did it take so long, or questioning whether or not that actually happened to them. And women or survivors just choosing, you know what, I don't want to go through that. I don't want to be stigmatized with that, you know?
Now, in 1995, the socialist premier of Japan, Prime Minister Tomichi Murayama, made a heartfelt apology to the Comfort Women and set up a fund. But in more recent times, there's been a lot of backpedaling by Japanese politicians. Your movie's called The Apology. So there was an official apology, but what is the apology they're seeking in the movie?
The main thing that the grandmothers have been wanting over all these years is to make sure that this story is passed down, that education's instilled, that this is put into the history textbooks, that this is not washed out away, and that there is a museum that actually showcases and honors these women. And these peace statues are created now and to honor these women, and they're placed all around the world, and there's a few in Seoul. There's actually one here in Toronto on Bayview.
Really?
That people can people can go and see and sit next to her. And so their primary goal is to get this out there, this history out there, to have it taught, as well as, you know, to be able to seek retribution for not just the South Korean grandmothers, but also for grandmothers, survivors all across Asia as well. Because a lot of the apologies and said compensation that they were going to issue really was specifically to the Korean survivors, and not really recognizing the Indonesian, the Philippine, the Chinese, the Taiwanese, the Dutch, so on and so forth.
Now, your film, The Apology, will be spreading this word, but what do you want the average Canadian viewer to take from this movie?
One thing that I'm so proud to know that so many people that have watched the film, because the film's been doing really well around the world, and so many audience members has come away with how much the grandmother, these women's story has resonated with them, has really sit with them, because this is ultimately, yes, it touches on the history and the atrocities that happened to them, but it really is a powerful human story that gives us hope, that encourages us, that I believe will start changing the way that we talk about these issues, that we talk about these stories. And I believe that these grandmothers do inspire that dialogue that happens. And so I'm seeing that with audience members. I'm seeing that when they come up to me after the film, they're like, wow, these women, I can't get them out of my head. And that to me feels like we've done a great job in being able to share, you know, that their essence and to have their stories really resonate with a very global audience. So I'm excited for it to have its theatrical release in Toronto. I can't wait for people back in Toronto to be able to watch it, because I know we had sold out screenings during Hot Dogs. So now people will be able to watch it.
I saw the Hot Dogs and it stayed with me till now. It's a
so film. There. Yeah, great.
Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Tiffany Xiong's NFB feature documentary called The Apology, about wartime comfort women, is opening today in Toronto. This is Daniel Garber, the Movies, each Friday morning on CIUT 89.5 FM and on my website, culturalmining.com.